So today, the reading from the worship calendar, Matthew 3, gathers us to the side of the Jordan River where John the Baptist is washing people, and Jesus shows up for his first public appearance. So get comfortable, because with this brief moment of Jesus and water, Matthew retells the entire long story between God and Israel. So, deep breath. The Jordan River, for thousands of years, is the major source of water for life in Israel. The water in the Jordan starts from Mount Hermon between modern Syria and Lebanon. It runs down south through the Sea of Galilee and then on through to the Dead Sea, which is the lowest point on earth. So the river forms a natural border on the west side of Israel. In Bible times, Israel calls the land beyond the Jordan the wilderness. Today is the Kingdom of Jordan. On the Israel side of the river, there is a very choice swath of farmland in the Jordan Valley. We now know it as the West Bank, as the area of ongoing hot potato land dispute where Palestinians have settled. So the Jordan is not only important to the physical life of the people of Israel, it's also the location of important events in their history. Beginning 4,000 years ago, when according to Genesis, God befriended a man named Abraham in Babylon before it was an empire, and told him to pack up and migrate across the wilderness to this land beyond the Jordan. Abraham was not shown any brochure to where God was taking him, but the first time he stood on the side of the Jordan River and laid eyes on the Jordan Valley real estate, he commented in Genesis 13 that it was as fertile as the land besides the Nile in Egypt, that the land was so well irrigated, it was like God's private garden. So this was the same place, centuries later, that Moses called the land flowing with milk and honey when Abraham's descendants had become slaves in Egypt. And Moses told them God was going to fight Pharaoh for the freedom, and he was going to lead them across the wilderness to land God had prepared for them to settle in, to begin life as the people of God's kingdom on earth. So this exodus from Egypt would become the most important story in the history of the Jewish people. How God, through Moses, rescued them and then personally guided them out of Egypt across the wilderness to the west shore of the Jordan River and then crossed over the Jordan into the promised land. How God was with them the whole way is why they love this story. God crossed over with them and then gave them everything they needed so they could live the life of a free people, the life they could only dream about when they were slaves in Egypt. They love this story because God, the creator of the universe, cared about them so much that he hatched a rescue plan for a bunch of slaves. Just because God promised Abraham his descendants would be taken care of. And God kept his promise. They just needed to be brave to say yes and put their trust in God and follow him across the unknown to get them from there to here. So in our passage today, some 2,000 years after God shook hands with Abraham, John the Baptist brings us back to the storied spot on the side of the Jordan, where his people crossed over into this lush land from slavery to begin their new life as free people, except that good life in the land had taken a dark turn. The few hundred years before Jesus had been spiritually confusing. This land promised to them by God was invaded and overrun several times by foreign superpowers. The people have been scattered all over as slaves again, passed around from empire to empire. In Jesus' time, they were now back in their own land, but in name only. The king was a puppet of the Roman Empire who had no rightful claim to the throne. For the people who still cared about their origin story, they were wondering about that promise God made Abraham. Whatever happened to that, they wondered. God felt far and confusing. Was it something they did that disappointed God and drove God away? And then there was this uphill battle of hanging on to their Jewish values and identity as a people in the domineering religion and culture of the empire. People felt lost, like sheep without proper shepherds. That's how Jesus described his people, and it made them cry. This was the backstory. When one day Jesus' cousin John found a spot along the Jordan River where his people had followed Moses across the wilderness and crossed over into the promised land with stars in their eyes, and John began calling people to wade into the river for ritual of major spiritual wash. Because according to John, God was about to breathe new life into that old promise. This thing John was saying and doing was provocative and controversial. The kingdom of heaven has come near, he says, to the empire, talking about an approaching kingdom as a war cry. And John wasn't a priest. He didn't have the proper licenses to do spiritual cleanses. Official cleansing rituals were done at the temple by proper priests in large tubs. So John was not so subtly poking at the corrupt religious and ruling authorities like a guy opening up a coffee shop on a corner with three Starbucks. John would eventually lose his head for his brave talk, but he risked his life to put a spotlight on the seriousness of spiritual contamination, the sort that created an uncrossable gulf between people and God, like the Jordan at high tide. The whole Jewish religion and their temple rituals was about removing spiritual dust, as it were, so people could enter the presence of God. But because of the sloppy state of the temple, because the officials and priests at the temple had turned their sacred religion into a for-profit business, the problem of spiritual dust had been compounding and was now out of control. This was not news to anybody listening to John. They knew if they wanted God back in their lives, they needed God to first remove this contamination. That's what John was doing with his pop-up spiritual clinic, to do a deep spiritual clean in the running water of the Jordan River. Because the thing his people had been waiting for and praying for a few centuries was about to happen. The Savior they had been waiting for, God's hand-picked Messiah, was about to arrive and rebuild God's kingdom on earth like a second coming of Moses. For anyone who wanted to get in on this thing God was doing, anyone who wanted citizenship to this new kingdom, they would prepare and get ready by saying yes to John's invitation to a good spiritual bath. So John invites people to repent, which means to turn around. Is setting a new course on the GPS, for moving in a direction away from God to a new direction of moving towards God. The U-turn about happened in the water, when they stepped out and waded into a river, when John pushed them under to watch up everything that would separate them from the presence of God. When they come out of the river and walk back on shore, it was like they went back in time to that first crossing 1,500 years earlier, before everything went sideways. Symbolically, they were crossing the Jordan again, a second time, for a do-over. And according to Matthew, people jumped at John's offer. This was the new start with God that everyone had been praying for, and it was happening. So, it was on the side of the Jordan where John was making his U-turn pitch that a grown-up Jesus made his first public appearance as the person that God has chosen to lead God's people again in a new Exodus story. And just like the first time, God didn't send people to cross over alone. Jesus was God coming to make the trip with them every step of the way. Even though John and Jesus were cousins about the same age, they didn't seem to have much of a relationship growing up. Beyond knowing each other existed, they lived in different places. and circumstances kept them apart. But the way Jesus tells it, John knew Jesus' secret identity and his mission, and the moment he saw Jesus showing up at his rally, he knew it was go time. He was expecting Jesus to take over the clinic for him, so it threw him when Jesus asked John to wash him too. John refused, because Jesus, being God the Son, didn't need a spiritual cleansing, and because John, in the proper order of things, thought he would be knighted by the king and not the other way around. But Jesus insisted to be baptized into Jordan because he told John it had to be this way. It had to be this way, I think, because Jesus wanted people to know he was the kind of king who stood in solidarity with his people. He was one with them. And he was the kind of king, just like God the Father, who went into the water with his people, so his people would never be left to face life alone on the other side. God never leaves his people on their own. He's always in the thick of it with us. And to mark this coronation when Jesus came out of the water, Matthew says God's Spirit landed on Jesus like a dove, and God said, "This is my Son whom I love, with him I'm well pleased." The message is more to the point. This is my Son, chosen and marked by my love, the light of my life. These are words from Isaiah 42:1. It's the words of God's letter of endorsement vouching for his chosen servant, and Jesus is the chosen one the world had been waiting for. And this royal announcement marked the beginning of Jesus' 3-year mission to rescue creation from the forces of spiritual death and the contamination that separates us from our Creator. And Matthew wants us to know that it was such a momentous occasion that all three persons of God showed up for this, Father, Son, and Spirit, all together for the photo op of all time. Matthew tells Jesus' baptism story like he stepped out of a crowd out of nowhere. But actually, Matthew starts his biography of Jesus in chapter 1 with a genealogy that traces Jesus' ancestry through the royal line of King David, and then all the way back to Abraham, because Matthew wants to remind us of the whole story of God, that the reason God sent Jesus into our world is God doing the same thing that God has always done since the beginning of space-time, that we matter deeply to God. It's why he created the universe. It's why he wants to have a relationship with us and do life together with us. But he always leaves it our choice, whether we also want what he wants. So ever since Adam and Eve said no to life with God and chose instead to leave God and the Garden of Eden to strike out on their own and live on their own terms, God had been popping up to extend a hand of friendship to invite people to turn back to being friends with him, like he did with Abraham. So Jesus is God coming to us in the flesh, is what God does, turning his face to us with his hand stretched out to see if we would also turn our face towards him and accept that hand. And the Jordan River is a symbol of that yes, the invitation now extended to anyone, and not just Jewish people, to step out of our life, back into the river, and come out to cross over again. And we step out of the water like a sort of rebirth, as a child who now calls God Daddy, into life in God's kingdom where God is the king, a life where God is no longer a stranger, but our friend and ally. When the Hebrew slaves first came out of the wilderness to the western shore of the Jordan River, after 40 long years of camping around the wilderness in circles, they could see the promised land on the other side, but the water in the raging river was in the way. It was flood season, and there was no way over. But they had been in this situation before, 40 years earlier, when they were escaping Egypt with Pharaoh's army chasing after them. They came to the side of the Red Sea, and just like now, there was no way over. You remember what happened there if you've seen the movie or been to Disneyland? God told Moses to stick his staff into the water, and the water miraculously parted for the entire caravan to walk over. And when the Egyptian army went into the river, the walls of water crashed down over them. So here, on the side of the Jordan, God did this thing again. Joshua, who was now the guy in charge, did what God told him. The priest carrying the ark with the Ten Commandments in it were the first people to put their foot into the water. The moment they did, the water parted. These priests with the ark then walked to the middle of the riverbed and stayed there until everyone had made it across. This was the symbol of God's presence going first, leading the way, making sure the way is clear. Right behind the priests with the ark were 12 men, one from each tribe. They were told to each pick up a stone from the bottom of the river and carry them to the other side with them. Joshua also rolled up 12 stones and piled them up in the middle of the riverbed. The 12 stones they carried with them were the new life going forward. And the 12 stones in the river were the things from the old life that they didn't need anymore, and they left them in the river, which is one of the things we do when we were baptized. We leave the old things that drag us down in the water, and we emerge from the water with new gifts and blessings from God for a new start with Him. So they were stuck one moment, and then God made a way, which was what God was offering people again through John by the Jordan River, a chance to wash off things that drag them down and leave them in the river and start over clean. Now, can you imagine being one of those priests, the ones in front carrying the ark with the Ten Commandments in it, which was kind of like the friendship contract between God and His people, and he was told he had to stick his foot into the raging river? Do you think there was any bit of doubt or hesitation? He might not have been born yet when they crossed the Red Sea 40 years earlier, but what went through his head, do you think, when he had to decide if God was trustworthy at the moment he put his foot down and take a step into the river, looking up at the wall of water and wondering, is it going to hold? So the crossing of the Jordan is as much a physical challenge as it is also a psychological and a spiritual one. It is looking at some scary thing in front of us and choosing whether to go all in with God and leap forward without any guarantee that it will work out in the way we hoped. We might be tempted to turn back and go back to what we knew that made us head out into the wilderness in the first place, even though it wasn't really working for us. But some people say the devil, you know, is better than the unknown. 40 years earlier, standing on the edge of the Red Sea, some of the Hebrew slaves thought about turning back, and they might have if there wasn't an army blocking the way. So as you look over the river to 2023, what do you think is waiting for you as you cross over? Is it something good or something scary? Does what you see fill you with a sense of adventure or some dread about whether you have it in you to go head to head with some challenge? What's on the other side of the river? Do you even want to cross, or do you rather turn back if it's an option? The thing God promises us is that if we're ready to cross, He reminds us He is the God who makes order out of chaos, beginning in Genesis, when He held back the watery chaos to make a space so life can happen, so we living things can breathe and thrive. This is the language of the creation story. After God made the universe, Father, Son, and Spirit pose for that same photo, just like the one at Jesus' baptism. The Spirit hovered over the waters, Genesis says. Jesus with his sleeves rolled up and arms a bit dirty from all the gardening, and God doing a thumbs up with a big smile because he was so pleased with how everything turned out. So when Jesus came out of the Jordan and Father, Son, and Spirit posed for that photo a second time, it was as if creation was being created all over again for a do-over. And the breath that Jesus took coming out of the water was like a flashback to Adam taking his first breath. The other thing God does is that he always offers to cross over with us if we want him to. Every time water floods the banks of our lives and chaos rushes in, God is there with us, holding out a hand to pull us up and to offer to restore order if we would trust him and follow him through the waters. It may not be the life we have known before the storm, but he will help us adjust to the new normal. There's a writer who wrote this: when I started planting seeds, I started to feel differently about rain. When we take God's hand, things that might ruin us can end up growing us, because God can always make order out of chaos. He did it with Noah through the water of the great flood, and Jesus did it with his disciples when they were caught out in the lake during a storm. It was scary, it was touch and go, but God was there with them and brought them through the chaos and led them to the other side. What do you make of the fact that last year in BC, the number one baby name parents chose was Noah, after the guy and the family God brought through a great storm? So Jordan is the border between two realities, two worlds. On the one side of the Jordan is the wilderness, barren, uncultivated, where God doesn't matter, unknown, unfelt. On the other side is where God is king, where God turned the wilderness into a lush garden, into a livable space by holding back chaos. And Jesus is like those border crossing guides for people looking for a better life. God holds out a hand, offering to be with us and guide us through the wilderness and the wild waters to a new life in the new land on the other side. In Joshua 4:17, the message says, "And there they stood. Those priests carrying the chests of the covenant stood firmly planted on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan, while all Israel crossed over dry ground. Finally, the whole nation was across the Jordan, and not one wet foot." So as we cross over and prepare to take on what's waiting for us in the new year, may your foot not get wet. And even if it does, may the water grow what God is planting in our souls, that in the chaos, however scary, however our faith gets stretched, God will help us to lean into his promise to guide us through, so the water cannot ruin us, but instead grows fruit in us. So, a moment for you to begin a conversation with God, and we have Malcolm Guite this morning. So, take a moment. Also reading this morning is Psalm 29. This is Malcolm Guite. "Call us, O Christ, and open up the gate. Call us to worship with your mighty voice, the voice that sings through rivers in full spate, the voice in which the forests all rejoice, the voice that rolls through thunderclouds and calls the deep seas and steep waves, the quiet voice that stirs our sleeping conscience and recalls us to the love we had abandoned, leads us through the parting mists of doubt, or falls upon us like a revelation, pleads with us upon the poor's behalf, blazes in glory from each burning bush, and bleeds out from compassion's wounds, the voice that raises our drooping spirits till we dance for joy, and gives us too a voice to sing his praises." Amen.